Fly me to the moon. Let me play among the stars. Let me
that, ladies and gentlemen, is Frank Sinatra. I am Rick Hogan, doing my best to fill in for Bill and Wendy today from 10 minutes ago till noon, and tomorrow from 10 to noon. I'm playing Sinatra because Sinatra is the greatest saloon singer I've ever heard. And from 11 to noon, I'm talking about taverns and saloons with three notable tavern keepers and bartenders. But my first guest, and I'm always very pleased to talk to her, is Dana Montana. Dana, hi.
Mr. Cogan, how are you?
Hey, how cold is it up there?
Oh, my God.
She's in Lake Geneva. So it's got to be a little colder than here, right?
Pretty much equal to Chicago. I mean, we're right over the borderline. So, you know, your weather is my weather usually.
Sure.
But it is really cold. I haven't seen a cold day like this in a long, long time.
Well, one of the things about, you know, I think one of the great things, and I'm so glad you're on, one of the great things is this week is going to be relatively mild. It's going to be in the 30s most of the time, which is, I think, the perfect time. The roads will be clear to drive up to Lake Geneva and go to a place called the Dancing Horses, which is Dana Montana's life, the manifestation of Dana Montana's lifelong passion with horses and animals. You do, we'll talk a little, you're going to be on the whole half hour. You have a very special Christmas. Christmas means a lot to you, Dana, hasn't it?
Oh, gosh, yes. Yeah, because as a little girl, every Christmas I would wish for that pony that never came. So Christmas will always have a special meaning for me. You know, I don't know of too many little girls that don't wish for the pony at Christmas morning.
Well, you have a lot of ponies up there. They're horses, though, aren't they?
Oh, yeah, the Arabian horses, one of the most prestigious breeds in the world, where most horses really came from.
And sure.
Back in the, from, you know, the ancestry of them. But we have over 50 beautiful Arabian horses, plus other ones that are in the show, other breeds, too. We never show partiality. Your horse is a horse is a horse, and everybody loves their own special kind.
Well, but I got to tell you something. In the shows, I've been up there a number of times with the little Fiona, not so little anymore, and some of her friends. And the great thing about it is the show is constantly evolving. I mean, you are changing the show. Dancing Horses during most of the year is a sort of very, very extravagant and I would say extraordinary balletic musical extravaganza. Am I making too much of it, Dana?
No, absolutely, yeah. Correct. Hard to visualize all of that, but it's so true. Every word you just said is what we are. It's, you know, everything that goes into the show has been developed over the 13-year history that we've been here in Lake Geneva doing this show. The saddest part of it is that people still don't know we're here.
It's amazing to me because everybody I know, and a number of them, are people who listen to this very radio station. You know this as well as I do, that everybody, to a soul, who sees the Dancing Horses says, oh, my God, that's an amazing thing. Isn't that?
Yeah.
I remember going up there, and Jory Luloff, the former TV anchor here, was there with her husband. They have a home nearby, and she had heard you on the radio, and she said, well, you know, we just thought we'd try it. By the end of the show, she and her husband, Richard Friedman, who once ran for mayor of Chicago, were blown away. And they're not kids. I mean, with kids, it's relatively easy to get it. But this is really sort of the classic definition of family entertainment, yes?
Oh, gosh, yes. Something that doesn't exist anymore, you know. I mean, I watch entertainment falling apart at the seams because of animal people who just don't understand animals and the love owners of animals or performers of animals have for them, and it makes me so sad. I mean, to go see a Ringling Brothers circus this year, I'm like, this is not Ringling Brothers. You know, the world is forcing changes to happen that should never change. The most beautiful thing in the world is animals, and animals who are showing their intelligence by being able to perform, which usually the performance is really whatever they do naturally, and it's just exaggerated by showing it as a, you know, an art or a trick. But we're still, you know, here we are with the horses and these beautiful horses, and I hope they never get to that end, you know, where they say you can't have a horse. I mean, they're throwing away carriage rides on horses.
Yeah, yeah.
So many things that are so unnecessary. Well,
one of the other things, and I'll talk to you more about this after the break, is the fact that in this increasingly electronic age, where if some kid wants to see a horse, they punch a few buttons on their phone and they will see a horse, which is, I cannot describe, it's like looking at a cheeseburger. The difference is looking at a cheeseburger and eating a cheeseburger. There is a world of difference. We're talking to Dana Montana, who runs among many entertainment venues up in Lake Geneva, including the Sugar Shack, one of my favorite places for many, many years. The Dancing Horses. Go to the website, thedancinghorses.com, and stay tuned. We'll be back with Dana momentarily. And a place you should also go is Lake Geneva, specifically. Lake Geneva is a very pretty place during Christmas time. But specifically to see the Christmas show at Dana Montana's The Dancing Horses. Dan, I was just talking to Ben Cortez, the engineer, the great engineer down here, and he's yet to go. And he says, my wife wants to go. We really want to go. There are so many people who want to go, but they get, don't you think they often get trapped in doing the same holiday things they've always done? We're going to go see the Windows at Fields. We're going to go see the Nutcracker. We're going to go see A Christmas Carol. My attitude is to always, every Christmas, add or try something new. Wouldn't the Dancing Horses be perfect for that?
Absolutely perfect. And it's only a day trip.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you're not spending money overnights if you don't want to and all that. You're driving down. It takes an hour and a half. And once you get here, you know, it's just unbelievable. I mean, the Dancing Horses, we have, of course, an afternoon show at 1 o'clock.
Oh, that's
mostly
perfect.
For our matinees. And you can see the matinee show, and then you can go over to Grand Geneva and drive through their acres and acres of beautifully decorated Christmas things.
See, I didn't even know that Grand Geneva did that. What I would say is then you can see the Dancing Horses show, and then you can go to the petting zoo or take a trip through the animal gardens you have there, because it's not just the Dancing Horses. You have that incredible singing bird who was like on America's... You have a bird up there who was one of the stars of America's Got Talent, right?
Right, right. And his name is Echo. And he is awesome. He also did the Volkswagen commercials a couple of years ago.
Did he really?
He is very talented. And we have a theater that is dedicated to Echo and his furry friends. And you see that show along with the Dancing Horses show. And like I said, it's only a day trip. So it's not like going to the Dells where you got to stay overnight. You're only an hour and a half away and come here and... Like I said, the Christmas in the country at Grand Geneva is just breathtaking.
Isn't
it
also
really puts you in the Christmas mood? You know?
Isn't also, Dana, as I remember it, I haven't been up there in a couple of years at Christmas, but downtown Lake Geneva too is it's sort of like something out of It's a Wonderful Life. It really is. It will give you the Christmas spirit if you're unable to get it on State Street or Michigan Avenue or someplace, right?
Right. You got to be able, like you said, to be flexible to do things that are different, and there isn't much choices left anymore.
Yeah.
But different, you can't get any different than Dancing Horses. I mean, the costumes, the horses match the rider in the costumes. And what I love about it, Rick, is so many of the men come here with their wives or they brought the grandchildren and all that, and they come in, you know. I couldn't watch the damn Packers and Bears play today, but we had to come to see this show, you know.
We got to come see horses, yeah.
And they come in that way, and I go, oh, okay. And they go out, and they go, holy cow.
Yeah.
I am so
I've seen that. I've seen that. I've seen that myself.
Not what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. Well, that's what everybody says. I mean, and it is. I mean, it is. It has that kind of sophistication in a show that you would find, you know, not anywhere between Lake Geneva and Las Vegas, I would hazard to say. I mean, this is, there's incredible music. There is, you know, that, what do you call that water thing that you have?
Oh, the dancing water show.
Yeah, it's like these fountains and dancing waters, and the horses are really amazing, and the ladies who ride them are very showgirl-like attractive, right?
Beautiful, yes.
Now, how many people do you have working for you up there now? Because many of them work in the animal gardens portion. These people are all people with ambitions to work in zoos, where many of them have wound up working.
Yes. Anybody who loves animals, they just love working here. They also, most of the people live here on property. In the summer, the activity in the animal gardens, the zoo, is tremendous. In winter, we put everything indoors.
Yes, well,
I mean,
you should.
I would never leave one of my animals out in weather like this. So we have all indoor facilities heated where all the animals go. So we really emphasize the birds and the horses at the time of the year.
Sure, sure.
And the horse show this year, it stars Christine Zerbini, who is a girl that used to be here when I very first opened.
Yeah.
And then left and was with Ringling Brothers for years. She's ninth generation performer in the circus.
Wow.
And she's with us, and she does, oh my God, the things that she can do off a horse's back are just sit on the edge of your seat.
Now, Dana Montana, when you do a sort of Christmas-themed show, that must go through, like, the beginning of the new year, yes?
Yeah, till January 15th.
So many
people can't get here.
Yeah,
before,
of course.
But they get here after, because after Christmas is over, you're definitely looking for something to do.
Well, and that's the week, and the next 2 weeks. I mean, a lot of kids are not off this week. They're off the next 2 weeks, sort of after Christmas. So this becomes, mm-hmm. you know what, ladies and gentlemen, you could try this for a new Christmas activity that could start, like, 2 days after Christmas and go up there when things are nice and relaxed and there's not a lot of traffic on the roads and there's no, like, familial pressure beating you down. So what, Dana, what is special about, I'm sure there's a ton of Christmas music in the Christmas show. I'm sure the costumes are Christmas-themed, kind of, yes?
Right. Special this year is Christine Zerbini's Roman riding, which is, you know, you're standing on the backs of two horses separated only by a set of reins.
Wow.
And when she comes out to Christmas theme music standing on these two horses, it's like watching the Statue of Liberty come to life, you know. You cannot believe that this girl is balancing on these two animals. We have trick riding in the show this year, and we have a unicorn, a live unicorn.
Well, of course you do. Of course you have a unicorn. Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the only place to see a live unicorn in the United States of America is at the Dancing Horses. Dana, the place is simply a glorious manifestation of your lifelong passion for horses. I have never met anybody who cares as much about not only horses and the care of horses, but in allowing horses to entertain people, because you see in those eyes of those kids and adults the same thing you probably saw when you looked in a mirror when you were a little girl. I'm an incredible admirer of what you've done out there, and it's now 13 years. And ladies and gentlemen, if you simply go to the website, thedancinghorses.com, I think you've sensed Dana's affection for all of this. You will get a real, it's not the same as being there, but I think if you go to the website, you will be further intrigued to drive an hour and a half north or so. If you live in Woodstock, it's about half an hour. Dana, Merry Christmas, honey.
Oh, Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas, sweetie. I hope to see you soon.
Thank you again for calling, Rick. And
oh, no.
Fiona, her namesake horse, is still here in the show.
That's right. When you people go up there, say hello to Fiona the horse, okay? I will say hello to Fiona the little girl. Dana, take care of your sweet self.
Thank you, darling.
All right, honey. Okay, we get a little commercial break, and after the news, then we will talk about American Bandstand. Given the demographics of the station, I think it's the perfect subject.
You have the cool, clear
Eyes of a seeker of wisdom and truth. Welcome back. That's Frank Sinatra singing, because Frank Sinatra is the greatest saloon singer of my lifetime. And from 11 to noon, I will have three of the great barkeeps in the history of this town in here: Colin Cordwell of the Red Lion Pub, Bruce Elliott of the Old Town Ale House, and Jeff McGill, late of the Billy Goat Tavern. My guest right now is Sharon Sultan Cutler. Those of you who listened to me last night from 10 to 11 heard this very person on the air, and I thought, well, I could just replay it, or I could make Sharon get up and do it all over again. Hi, Sharon.
Hi. You did it.
Yeah, I did it. Well, it's not that hard. Plus, you get to stay home today. Sharon is the author, along with Arlene Sullivan and Ray Smith, of a fascinating book called Bandstand Diaries, The Philadelphia Years, 1956 to 1963. And it says on the book, it's a collector's limited edition that can be had by going to bandstanddiaries.com. The book you've waited for over 50 years to read. Why, Sharon? Now, you talked a little about it last night, but you're the one, and there to follow in the footsteps of a lot of people who could never pull this off, right?
Correct. Dick Clark had done a book. As a matter of fact, Ray Smith, my co-author, did a lot of the work on his book, and that was in 1997. So there really hasn't been a book featuring the regulars, and people have always wondered whatever became of.
Well, you especially wondered, because you, when you were 10 years old and you ran home from school and your mom would give you milk and cookies,
right,
and then you'd turn on the TV and you'd dance along with this. Would you hazard to say that everybody of your generation had a crush on somebody on that show?
I think so. The guys loved Arlene, mm-hmm, and they loved Justine. Carol Scaldiferri was every guy's dream. And Pat Molitori, people loved her for her dancing. The guys, Kenny Rossi, girls swooned over him. Bob Clayton, my guy.
Your guy. Decades later, before he died, you finally got to tell him that you had a crush on him. How did he react to that?
Well, you heard two very adult people giggling. We got a kick out of that. You know, he didn't know what I look like now, and I didn't know how he looked, because he had sent me photographs. But it was fun, because these people, Bob was on the cover of teen magazines. Everyone was. They were just like the celebrities.
Well, I mean, they were, in a sense, and you make the point in your book, Bandstand Diaries, The Philadelphia Years, 1956 and 1963. These actually, in their way, were the first reality stars. Now we're awash in reality stars,
right,
most of them not very substantial at all. These were the first, weren't they?
Absolutely. Arlene had a couple of people, many, many people, who followed her romance with Kenny. And one of the girls wrote in to us that she contacted Western Union when one day Arlene did not dance with Kenny. And she started to report to this woman at Western Union that, "I'm very worried about Arlene and Kenny. They're broken up, you know." And what happened is the Western Union person said, "Well, you have to come here to a Western Union office, and it'll be such and such amount of money." And she didn't realize that you couldn't just tell them something, so she just hung up and waited for them to go back to dancing the next day.
You, from your initial fascination and affection for the show when you were 10 and 11 and 12 and 13, it then sort of, you kind of, I don't know, grew out of it,
grew
away from it.
Absolutely.
And it resurrected itself, you know, just poo-pawing social media. But social media is kind of what brought you back to the idea for the book, right?
Absolutely. There were a few Facebook pages that had American Bandstand in their title, or Dick Clark.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was this gentleman who was going to do a book, and he had a very big presence online, and his book never materialized.
nothing ever came of it. In interviewing, and the first person, you got to meet Arlene, and she sort of helped facilitate getting in touch with the network of regulars, yes?
Correct. Arlene is extremely well-liked, and she's one of the few, I would say, totally neutral people that everybody who was a regular liked. And she would vet me, and, you know, it, with some people, it was difficult because they didn't want to be part of American Bandstand any longer,
yeah.
Which was very sad in
yeah.
a way.
I mean, they were, but most of the people, and what I get from your book, which I've read cover to cover, Bandstand Diaries, The Philadelphia Years, 1956 and 1963, is that most of the people who were associated with the show, who were the regulars, for them, it's a very fond time. It is not, well, I was a big shot when I was 16, and now and then I became an accountant, and then I became a drunk or something. it's a fond memory for them, is it not?
Absolutely. Their whole lives, they went to school, like Justine said, she was a great student. She got all A's and perfect attendance in high school. But for the most part, they loved it. The social life extended after the show was on in the afternoon. They had parties. They also were bused to different sock hops and stuff like that.
Yeah, they made public appearances around different places, but none of them got, it seems to me, and I may be wrong, I may have missed it, but none of them seemed to have gotten that sort of showbiz bug where they said, wait a minute, I was a huge star on American Bandstand, so I want to a la something now like American Idol or something. They never really took great advantage of it.
A few tried. Kenny Rossi was a singer for a time. He cut a few records. And then also Bob and Justine cut a record together. And Bob went out to Hollywood and tried to make it in films and in singing, and it didn't work. So they came back. He went into, from show business, he went into the shoe business.
And they have no real regrets. I mean, you have really hit a nerve with the public. How did you get Bobby Rydell, who appeared on the show, he's a Philadelphia kid, he appeared on the show a number of times. How did you get him to write an introduction for this? Was that easy?
Arlene.
Yeah.
First of all, I had a crush on Bobby. I had a crush on Bob, Bob Clayton. So Arlene is still friends with these people. Bobby Rydell lives in the Philadelphia area where Arlene always, you know, appears. And there's a lot of dances for older people.
Mm-hmm.
And she goes to them.
Wow.
So Arlene, it's like a new subculture. People are... I wish we had this in Chicago. I'm not aware of anything like that. I would love to go to a sock hop or something.
Well, you would be the one. You, dear, would be the one to start it because Sharon Sultan Cutler, who has written this book, Bandstand Diaries of Philadelphia Years 1956 and 1963, with her co-authors Arlene Sullivan and Ray Smith, you'd be the one to start this. Sharon, hang on for a couple minutes because I want to talk to you about what you have noticed as you have been out and about with this book. There was a big party for the book in Philadelphia. There was a big gathering here. And I want you to talk to me, after a couple minutes of commercials, about what you really think this touches in people. It's not simply, my theory is it's not simply nostalgia. So think about that, Sharon. We'll be back in a couple minutes.
Okay.
Welcome back. This is Rick Hogan filling in for Bill and Wendy. The next hour will feature three wise men talking about taverns, about which they know quite a bit. You can order the book Bandstand Diaries, The Philadelphia Years, 1956 to 1963, by going to bandstanddiaries.com. I will not insult you by spelling that for you. My guest is one of the three authors of that book, Sharon Sultan Cutler, who now lives on the northwest side of Chicago, but perhaps you can tell from her charming accent, she's a Long Island kid. Sharon, what has been the big revelation. I know you like the book. I like the book very much. But I think the response to the book has been surprising a bit to you in the enthusiasm of those who've read it. Yes?
Yes. A definite yes. I hear from people all the time, and they said to me how much American Bandstand was a part of their lives, a part of their growing up years, and to be able to relive it through the book and the people in the book makes people so happy because it was a good time for them, the time that they spent watching the show, writing to the regulars and just loving it.
And I also think you have a lot of pictures of the regulars and how they look now, and I think it probably in many cases some people go, hey, look, so-and-so got old too. You know, so-and-so yes. got old, and I look pretty good for my age. One of the other fascinating elements of the book, because I was not a big American Bandstand watcher. I did watch it, but I certainly didn't dance in our living room to it.
Right.
The chapter by Ray Smith on Dick Clark is fascinating to me, because Dick Clark, who was fairly ubiquitous in the entertainment world, this is how he got his start. He was a kid DJ in Philadelphia when he was picked to host this show, wasn't he?
Right, and his taste in music was not rock and roll. He liked Patti Page and Debbie Reynolds and a lot of the jazz people. So he had to really learn rock and roll, just as we did.
Well, he learned fast, and the other thing, as we talked a little bit last night on that show called After Hours, is this show went a very, very, very long and important way to sort of making rock and roll acceptable to the parents of little Sharon Sultan and millions of other kids. This was watched by 20 million kids a day, ladies and gentlemen, at least. It made it palatable. Dick Clark was such a straight-laced guy, and the kids on the show, a lot of them from Catholic school. It took the fear out of rock and roll for parents, didn't it?
Right. Parents were very nervous about what their kids did. We grew up in an era when it was, I'm trying to remember the expression.
Juvenile delinquent.
Juvenile delinquents they were worried about. And we were told to be seen but not heard.
Right, right.
That was the expression I meant to say. And so we watched it and hoped that our parents would accept it. And they probably wondered why we weren't doing our homework.
It was only a half-hour show when it first started. That's okay. But talk about, were your parents nervous about you dancing alone in the TV room and using a door handle as a sort of...
They thought I was strange. They thought I was strange. But my father used to dance with a... what is it called? A broomstick.
Oh.
He used to do modern dancing or ballroom dancing.
Yeah.
And I used to come home from school sometimes, and if he was home, he was dancing with a broomstick. So I guess it runs in my family.
So it's our daughter's dancing with a doorknob. It's just fine. I think this will be just fine. Sharon, you're going to pursue this. I mean, the book has been, you self-published this thing, which I think was very smart, because I can just see some other publisher mangling this thing. It is filled with, I don't know how many pictures are in here. Hundreds.
Almost 700
pictures. You do a wonderful thing in here, too, because people are indeed of a certain age. You have one chapter, is sort of a tribute to the regulars who have died. And that's a lovely, lovely thing. They've all had... You know, you sort of know what their lives were like, and there are photos of every one of them. Is there another book, do you think, Sharon, about this topic?
I think there could be a follow-up.
Yeah.
I have my brain working right now. First, we have to, be on in the media and let people know about the book. The thing that was said to me... at the book launch November 4th was a lot of regulars came up to me and said, you know, people have tried to do this book before.
Yeah.
And you're the only one who ever did. So I felt very validated by that.
Well, you can also feel kind of proud about it, too, don't you?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I can see a documentary.
Oh, no question. No
right?
question. Especially, you know, a documentary that involves the astonishing salesmanship of Dick Clark. Dick Clark was, as it says in the book, he was not really buddy-buddy with the kids on the show, was he?
No, he was very much to himself. He was nice to the kids, but
yeah.
It was sort of controlled, you know.
He was very, very focused, and he became, you know, a millionaire. If he didn't like rock and roll before he got on this show, he learned to like it because
he was a good actor.
Yeah,
too. And he was an actor. He was in several movies.
Yeah,
too.
I know.
He tried everything. Yeah.
Sharon Salton Cultured, now a Cutler, a proud Chicagoan, lives on the Northwest Side with her husband.
Right.
Go to bandstanddiaries.com. See more about the book. Sometime this year, I'm sure Sharon will organize a sock hop somewhere where all you fans of American Bandstand can
let
go.
Us know.
Yeah, I guarantee you it's going to happen this year. Sharon, it's a great pleasure knowing you, and congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.
All right,
much,
take
Rick.
Care, hon. See ya.
Right.
Bye. A nice woman. Very, very nice woman. We'll take a break. We'll get some news, and we will talk taverns for 1 hour with three wise men. Not exactly my favorite Sinatra song, but Sinatra is my favorite saloon singer. And about, I don't know, again, this is Rick Kogan filling in for Bill and Wendy. A year or maybe two ago, I had one of the most pleasant hours I've ever had on the radio with now, because it's the holiday season, people, guys I'm calling the three wise men. They are Jeff McGill, who retired after 35 years of tending bar at the Billy Goat last Christmas Eve. Colin Cordwell, who runs what may be the closest thing I've seen to a tavern museum in the world, called the Red Lion Pub, sort of across the street from the Biograph Theater on Lincoln Avenue. And Bruce Elliott, who not only is the proprietor of the Old Town Ale House and a frequent presence there, but also a writer of immense talent. He writes a blog called The Geriatric Genius. I think Jeff McGill and I are the two loyalist readers. I want to start by, Jeff, you've been away from it for a year. What do you miss?
Absolutely nothing, Rick. No, I'm kidding. I'm kidding. What a, you don't miss me. Of course, I'm kidding. What a disservice to all those wonderful people. The denizens of the deep. I used to call it down there. Anyway, I stopped back for the first time Friday night, and they have kind of an annual ersatz Christmas party. And somebody just implored me to be there, and I was not going to ignore that. So I stopped, and I got to tell you, it was a flood of emotion. Really good ones at that. Pardon me.
But I'm just thinking, yeah. 35 years pacing up and back in that bar and having millions of conversations. Did you suffer any withdrawal?
Yeah, you do. You do certainly. It's somewhat mitigated by the drudgery and the toil I became very, very weary of as time went on. On-demand labor is not the same as kind of things you wish to do yourself, and there's a certain zen that might attend that. I think about Bruce. I used to follow his stories about doing his working on the nursery over in Michigan, and that kind of thing where you work, and it sounded like it was like really labor intensive, but he enjoyed doing that. After a while, it was the drudgery of the bar that got to me. Indeed, there are relationships though that are only unique to taverns, to bars. There's no other way to access that, and I did miss that, and I was reminded of that, no uncertain terms, Friday night.
Colin and Bruce, what do you think about that? You guys are constant presences at the Red Lion Pub and at the Old Town Ale House.
Well, first I want to say I'm ticked that he's retired because as every psychiatrist needs another psychiatrist to talk to, every bar owner needs another bar owner too, and Jeff's not there anymore. I go by to see Bruce, but I manage to catch him when he's not in. But, you know, Bruce, I don't know.
Bruce, well, you used to be a fairly regular at the Billy Goat.
Well, Jeff's unique, and Jeff has really become the personality at the Billy Goat. And if you go in there now, it's not there, and there's nobody that can tell you who the pictures on the walls are. I think I know a little bit about owning bars now, and you don't let a guy like that slip through your fingers. And I think that's very poor ownership when that happens. I mean, there's ways that you can, prevent that from happening. And Jeff should never have been allowed to leave, certainly completely, like he did, because that bar it's a historical bar. There's not any other bar comparable to the Billy Goat, and it's history. There just isn't. And now the history's all gone. There's nobody there that can it's tourists. And I've been in there maybe twice. There were maybe one regular that I reckon. When you used to go in when Jeff was working, there was what they called the wise guy corner.
Yeah.
And I just, you know, I understand. I don't understand how things change, but... boy, I'll tell you, you get yourself a good bartender, and he's one of the Hall of Fame bartenders that I've ever known. I've got a couple pretty good ones myself. You don't want to lose them, and they're so important. I don't think people that open bars now understand how important your bartenders are.
Well, see, that's one point in this whole hour-long conversation we're going to have, that, yes, you can get a drink in a lot of different places. You can go to Walgreens and buy a bottle of liquor and drink it across the street outside. It's not about getting a drink. I think the people who tend bar and work bars are more essential than the booze. Colin?
Yeah. Well, you know, I always liken us to steam escape valves for society. You know, if you didn't have it. Well, I had a friend who was a shrink at Northwestern. He was an MD. He was a shrink. And he came in one night and he said, you know, I bet you they tell you stuff they don't tell me. I said, I guarantee you they tell me stuff that they don't tell you. I said, put a bar in your office. You know, for one thing, I don't know any of their friends, you know, and they're not going to spend $300 an hour. You know, it's like a cereal. They'll come in one week and tell me this, then they'll come in another week. And serving drinks is only a tangent to what we do for a living. You know,
Bruce, I mean, you wind up having not conversations with everybody in the bar, because you have a discriminating intellect, and so you won't talk with everybody.
Well, there are a lot of people that have discriminating intellects, too, that don't want to talk to me.
Yes, talk politics with Bruce Elliott. We got to take a break, but you guys are going to be here for the whole hour. It is Colin Cordwell of the Red Lion Pub, Bruce Elliott of the Old Town Ale House, and Jeff McGill. Jeff, when someone goes, what do you do now, what do you say? I'm late of the Billy Goat Tavern?
No. I played an embarrassing amount of golf this year. Embarrassing that it's probably at some level it's immoral to, you know, to access that much pleasure.
I suppose. I'm sure you didn't.
But
play
also because I probably don't play. You know,
well, you probably didn't play
better.
As much as Obama.
No, probably not. Yeah. Probably not.
All right, we'll take a break. We'll be back. I am talking, me, Rick Cogan, filling in for Bill and Wendy, to the three wise men, and we've come to the understanding in that first segment that a bartender, Colin Cordwell, said off air that he could teach a monkey to tend bar, but he can't teach a bartender personality. It is, to my mind, the essential element. Decor is one thing, and all three of these places, the Billy Goat, the Red Lion, and the Old Town Ale House, of course, sparked by Bruce Elliott's painting, his own paintings. They're all distinctive looking, but I think there's something more that makes a great tavern. It is a bartender. It's a combination. It's like an orchestra of some sort. Don't you all think, Bruce?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, really, I was going into a bar. I don't know. I had to kill some time not too long ago. I walked in and there were soap operas. There was a soap opera going on, and I go, my God, I can't watch, you know. I mean, I understand bar protocol. I mean, I know Jeopardy.
Better than anybody.
Jeopardy has to be on, but no, not
Not soap operas.
There's some things that the human being should not have to endure.
Well, all three of these plays, you're pretty minimalist when it comes to television sets. What's your theory about? You have a nice TV set in the Red Lion, Colin.
Well, I design my back bar. That's why I call it the Regenstein Library with a service bar. And it's interesting because it's a kind of a very subtle form of crowd control. You got a certain ilk in there, you know, with the baseball bat, hats backwards and stuff. They see the books. It's like it has the same effect of holding a cross in front of a vampire. You know, they're out of there faster than a set of jumper cables at a Lithuanian wedding. And it was the kind of atmosphere that I wanted. And, you know, and you attract the kind of people you want. But again, getting back to what Bruce and my friend Jeff, personality is key. I mean, I don't care if a guy's a mediocre bartender, but, you know, if he's got a good sense of humor, he listens, you know something about history, literature, politics. We'd like to stay clear of politics. You know, you'll never win on that front. You just have to nod your head a lot, you know. And I generally tell people anybody I vote for has been dead for 150 years, you know.
Jeff, you came there as a young man. How did your personality change behind that bar? Did it?
You know, I would... Rick, I would say I don't think so, and I would add to that I would hope not. You know, I just have this I espouse theories that say, you know, personality is set. Healthy personalities, you know, are set at all personalities, in fact, are set at a primitive time in our lives, and if somebody sees you after many many years and they say, look, you know, you're exactly the same, you know, as I remember you from grade school. That would be what you would want to hear is my thinking, is that you don't want to hear that you've reinvented yourself in some way, that you're the same guy. You know, you're the same guy you were. I used to think that I used to envy people that would speak of having eighth grade reunions. I always thought that they were the most valuable. You know, high school reunions or something, that's a different dynamic. You've got, you know, the people bragging about their success or people running off with former girlfriends and divorcing and that kind of thing. But eighth grade reunions, those are the kids you grew up with. And you knew their personalities. In many cases, you knew their parents, and you know, you knew who these people were. Anyway, I'm running a little bit too much on the theme, but no.
That's
as a matter of fact, I would like to think that I'm the same person I've always been. But what I wanted to speak about was, you asked about the taverns and televisions are minimal in all three of these places, and I was thinking about this ever since we got the invite, you know. How do you characterize what makes a good tavern? What's happened to the tavern business? And I think that there are two basic models, and Colin touched on one of them, and that's the therapeutic model, and that speaks to more directly to the bartender, and the bartender has to feel that it's an honor for to listen to these disclosures. That you have to feel that what this person is telling you, what he's disclosing about his life, sometimes more intimate than you would think, that you should consider that an honor. And there's a balance. There's a you know, that cuts both ways for you as a bartender. Getting back to the other aspect of the neighborhood saloon, the model for a good neighborhood saloon was the old American playground, and that's why things have changed, and that's why we're losing taverns, is because what we experienced phenomenologically as kids on the playground is lost. Now, this is generational. Kids don't. You walk by playgrounds in summer; they're empty. We had to fight for a diamond. We had to manufacture baseball diamonds and pick a home run fence or whatever, and that's gone now. Here's the point: kids knew how to play phenomenologically. It was self-directed. This sounds oxymoronic, but it was self-directed collective play. And taverns achieve that same thing. A good tavern does that. All these personalities come, and they know who's going to be there, who's going to show up. They hope there was always, you know, the certain kids were always going to be there. You could count on them. That's what a good neighborhood tavern could do.
Mm-hmm. Well, our bars have distinct personalities, and I kind of laugh when Colin said talking about politics, because we break every rule at the Old Town Ale House. And at the Old Town Ale House, I have to tell this when people call up to complain, the customer is always wrong. You're going to have to understand that. And that we believe that, and we act upon that, and we are very political, and it upsets people, and I'm fine with that. But that's who we are. And if for instance, when you talk about the TV, we had now, we're the North Side, and I'd say probably the majority of our customers are Cub fans. Of course, as I explained to Anthony on the Anthony Bourdain Show, my favorite, as being a Sox fan, a perfect day for a Sox fan is for the Sox to win, the Cubs to lose, then the Cubs' plane crashes. So when we watch the World Series, we watch the World Series with classical music on our jukebox. We always have a little classical music with the sound off of the Cubs. And the we didn't really get any complaints, not at least not that many. And if they did, we just asked them to, you know, there's certainly plenty of bars where they'll have the sound on. So, yeah, we all have distinct personalities, and I kind of like there's no music at all at the Billy Goat, is there?
There's a jukebox.
There is a jukebox. I never hear it.
There's a busboy that hums.
And because it only serves on one side, and you're forbidden from turning. People sit at the bar on the other side. If they were tourists, they come in. Hey, listen, I put some money in the jukebox. I can't hear it. I said, you have to go over there to listen to it.
that's not your modern
saloon.
Put
your ear up to it.
We got to get some commercials and then some news, but we're going to continue on this tavern talk with the three wise men, Colin Cordwell of the Red Lion Pub. Go to redlionchicago.com. Bruce Elliott of the Old Town Ale House. Go to Geriatric Genius. That's a blog, and you can read. Jeff and I are the loyalist readers of that blog. Or go to oldtownalehouse.com. It's in the heart of Old Town, two blocks from where I grew up. And the Billy Goat Tavern, where Jeff no longer works. There are a lot of Billy Goat Taverns around, and feel free to go there. I do want to talk when we get back from the news about celebrity and how that may have affected certainly the Billy Goat and certainly the Old Town Ale House after Anthony Bourdain came in for a visit and made Bruce justifiably the star of the show. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Rick Hogan filling in for Bill and Wendy. You guys can talk behind me. That's quite
all right.
We're talking about taverns, the importance and meaning of taverns, because these guys know them better than anybody I know, and I know them pretty well. Colin Cordwell of the Red Lion Pub, redlionchicago.com, Bruce Elliott of the Old Town Ale House, theoldtownalehouse.com, and just Google Geriatric Genius, and you will read Bruce's ongoing blog about his life as a proprietor of the Old Town Ale House and about his life in previous places and previous times, including the suburb that he calls sometimes Upper's Grove, meaning Downer's Grove, and about some of his golf triumphs over the years, among many triumphs. And Jeff McGill, who spent 35 years behind the bar at the Billy Goat Tavern, billygoattavern.com. All three of your bars do attract the so-called notables. Bruce, especially after the Anthony Bourdain show this year, where he featured you and the Ale House in a starring role. How has that changed?
Well, I'll say one thing. His fan base is great because we get people from all over the world coming in there now, and I have to watch my language. But the people that they're not people that you really wouldn't want to come in. They're totally cool. But as far as in fairness to the bar, long before I had it, celebrities were coming in. I mean, our proximity to Second City, and I tell people I would kill to have a picture. In 1968, when the Democratic Convention was going on, and my friend Lazar and I were out in the park, and we came in, we thought we'd go back to the house and get a couple beers. That was when all the craziness was going on, and it was still light out. And I remember walking in the bar, and if we could only have this picture, because sitting right at the head of the bar was Jean Genet, and then next to him was Norman Mailer, Jose Torres, who was the former light heavyweight champion of the world, Abby Hoffman, Allen Ginsberg, Gregory Corso, Paul Krasner. I mean, this was a Hall of Fame of and that is not that shocking in that bar. I mean, there are times when that's I mean, Michael Shannon, whose career has skyrocketed, he's a regular there.
Red Orchid Theater, right around the corner.
Key and Peele were in there not that long. I mean, so you just never know who's going to walk in there. So there's
about
always
people coming in and saying, "Hey, I want to see the star of that Anthony Bourdain show." Where's
well, they get to see him. I'm readily available, and when you're mentioning my blog, but my almost bestseller book, Last Night at the Old Town Ale House, is available at the bar and on Amazon.
I gave it a fabulous review, I thought, in the Chicago Tribune. Jeff, you being close to the what were then four daily newspapers, you had your share of celebrated and idiots down there, didn't you?
Oh, no, absolutely. Absolutely, Rick. And of course, but I had a well-nurtured reverence for the journalist. I maybe not everybody feels that way, but I certainly did. At least I did when I first started there. But you know, and of course, and I suppose that would be for me the most consistent kind of profound exposure to so-called celebrities, and a good number of them were celebrities in my mind, most notably Mike Royko.
Sure.
I think we would agree. But again, getting back to the magic of the tavern, what I like so much about it is that when you experience celebrity, you know, often enough, you begin to realize that, you know, a lot of the bloom comes off the rose, so to speak. But it's a good thing. It's kind of a healthy thing. And I like that aspect of things. And I think that most of these guys are looking for that to happen in their own interests. That the guys who, some of the names, the luminaries that Bruce just named, these guys didn't come down to be recognized as anything special. They want the playing field to be at that. As soon as they walk in that door, the playing field is level. It's level for everybody in the room. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And I'll tell you, walking into the Billy Goat, when I was a kid, when I was in my early 20s, and you see Mike Royko, Studs Terkel, and Nelson Algren sitting at a bar talking. And if you know anything about anything, you sit there and you're kind of in awe. But the bloom does come off the rose pretty quick when you start talking to him.
Well, one of the things you just mentioned, Jeff, that I think is inherent in a great tavern is it does level the playing field. You can walk in any one of your places and some other good taverns, the Red Lion included, and the bank president is treated exactly the same way as the cab driver, exactly the same way as the shipping clerk on the other side. Don't you think, Colin?
Absolutely. A good bar should be like a Masonic lodge. You know, everybody's got the same rank.
Yeah.
And we're talking about all these people who walk through your door. I've always likened owning a bar to having a Ouija board. You know, you never know what's coming through.
Right.
And
right.
You have a public door. I mean, you've experienced, you know, with the conveyor belt of humanity that you experience, you develop a sixth sense about human behavior. And
Bruce, do people get upset with you when you write? You don't often use their real names, but on your blog, I think it's now down to 2 days a week.
Yeah, although it is.
Yeah.
Well, I'm working on my next masterpiece right now, Portrait of the Genius as a Young Man, which
good
is
title.
Demanding a lot of time.
It's a good title. Do people get angry with you? I sense that some do, and I've read that some do.
Oh, I have people constantly. A good friend of ours now who runs a very important government agency right now, who's now up to, I call him Gugu.
Yes.
Gugu has requested that I never mention his name. I say at least a dozen times, but he's always, anyway, he's currently, his current incarnation is Gugu. And for you people that know about what they used to call good government people,
yes,
many years ago, you probably have a clue who this is.
Clue who it is. But mostly, inherently, what goes on in taverns stays in taverns.
Oh, it has to.
Yeah.
You better.
Yeah, you can't.
All agree with that. I mean, the Geriatric Genius is one of the most charmingly playful blogs that I know of that exists. But that is something, too, that this is a safe haven for people. Yes, Jeff?
Absolutely, and that is that. That's what begets the catharsis of the tavern experience. That's what people are looking. Letting their hair down and letting emotions, express themselves somewhat more freely. Obviously, enabled, and known in certain terms by beer and booze, of course.
Sure.
But that's what they're after, and indeed, there is some kind of healthy catharsis that takes place. I think, and knowing that, in fact, that a lot of it is protected. That's not going beyond that, as you mentioned.
True for you too, Colin. Of course, it must be.
Yeah, it's funny. After all these years I've spent in the business, I've come to understand that most of life is felt. It's not intellectualized. And for a lot of people, they're constantly fighting a war to get control of their emotions. And quite frequently, they're going to come into your place because they feel more comfortable there than they actually do at home. You know, they lower the yeah. temperature of their emotions. You know, Jeff or Bruce might provide a bomb that makes them feel better. You know, and it just makes life tolerable. Because for many people, life can be pretty intolerable.
Yeah. You know, it does. I mean, traditionally, the bars that existed across the street from the steel mills and the bars that existed across the street from the manufacturing places we used to have in this town, there were, as I've mentioned frequently, in the early 60s, there were 7,000 taverns, meaning 7,000 mm-hmm. liquor licenses in this town. It's now somewhere around 1,000, and I think that
we can thank Richie Daly for that.
Yeah, I know. Mm-hmm. I think it has sort of fractured various neighborhoods. I have always found and thought that taverns were as important to the fabric of a neighborhood as, and I mean this, as a religious institution.
Well, it's the hubbub of the local universe. Right?
Yeah,
people go to discuss wedding plans there. People go there after somebody's been buried. People go there when a kid's been born. People go there to discuss condo issues. They go there to discuss divorce issues. It's a place where it's a neutral spot,
yeah,
but a comfortable spot.
I'll never forget the day before we take a break that Fiona was born, and I left the hospital where Eli's was still operating on Chicago Avenue. I went in there very quietly. It was about 10:30 at night, and I ordered a drink and downed it and said, "Can I have another one?" And someone said, "Well, were you celebrating something?" I said, "Yeah, I just had a baby girl." And the guy went like this to the waiter and said, "Bring this man whatever he wants. Bring him a steak and all this." And I thought to myself, my God, there must be a lot of bars near hospitals where I could pull this scam every other night. We'll take a commercial break and be back with Bruce Elliott, Jeff McGill, and Colin Cordwell. But places you should visit over the holidays, if you have never been there, are the Red Lion Pub just north of Fullerton on Lincoln Avenue, the Billy Goat Tavern, the main oldest one, which is kind of on Lower Michigan Avenue. Its formal address is 430 North Michigan, but it's on Hubbard Street, or the Old Town Ale House, which is at 219 West North Avenue in the heart of Old Town. You should visit these places. I'm going to read my three guests, Colin Cordwell of the Red Lion, Jeff McGill, formerly of the Billy Goat Tavern, and Bruce Elliott of the Old Town Ale House. Raymond Chandler, who really liked to drink and was a very good writer, not quite at the level of Mr. Elliott here.
I consider him a peer.
Yeah, okay. Well, he wrote this. It's one of my favorite, to get this sort of romantic notion of bars. He wrote this in The Long Goodbye. "I like bars just after they open for the evening, when the air inside is still cool and clean and everything is shiny and the barkeep is giving himself that last look in the mirror to see if his tie is straight and his hair is smooth. I like the neat bottles on the back bar and the lovely shining glasses and the anticipation. I like to watch the man fix the first one of the evening and put it down on a crisp mat and put the little folded napkin beside it. I like to taste it slowly, the first quiet drink of the evening in a quiet bar. That's wonderful." It is wonderful.
Well, another L.A. Devotee of bars, Bukowski, he doesn't quite look at it that romantically.
No, he sure didn't.
In Barfly.
Yeah.
But I had the privilege of meeting him a couple times in San Francisco, and yeah, those are authentic guys. Chandler and Bukowski, and they knew
and they
how
got
to
it.
Write about bars.
They,
oh, absolutely.
They understood, yeah. Because you have to spend time in bars, I think. You gentlemen all have spent plenty of time in there, as have I, to really understand the importance of and the meaning of a good tavern in the fabric of life. Jeff, don't you agree?
Absolutely, Rick. And but I'm thinking as you've spoken, as he's describing, you know, this wonderful bar experience, this wonderful environment that he's so drawn to. I'm thinking if you're a kid, that may be, I mean, the prototype for that may be the local ice cream parlor. Huh. And where you begin to kind of, you know, absorb these environments that are so dear to you, and so that may be that's just an example of a possible, you know, prototype in your life, and I forgot where I'm going to go with this.
Don't worry. I'll tell a story about Jeff.
Yeah.
Last Christmas Eve, his last day on the job, I took little Fiona Cogan in there, who was then 11 years old, and we're sitting where we always sit in Wise Guy's Corner on a couple stools. I don't know if you two remember this story. And Jeff had created a drink for Fiona when she was three called the Fiona Sunshine, which was, you know, fruit juice and ginger ale or something. And Fiona sat down like a regular and said, Jeff, can I have a Fiona Sunshine? And Jeff came over and said, Fiona, this is the last Fiona Sunshine I will ever be making. And she didn't look at you. She looked at me and said, what's the matter, Dad? I said, well, Jeff is retiring. This is the last day he's ever going to work as a bartender. And she is certainly my child. She looked up at me and she said, tears in her eyes, but Dad, he's the only bartender I've ever known.
just to complete the thought, Bruce, Rick, was what I was getting at was that these environments, they're experiences that attend these unique environments, and when they're gone, those experiences are gone with them. So, when the neighborhood tavern is gone, there's nothing that's going to replicate that.
Yeah.
Nothing takes over for that. I mean, guys can sit in coffee. You go to a coffee shop, people are on their
phones. Or, shop. It's
certainly not Costco.
Club. Yeah, it's not the health club. It's
no.
Not.
You know, the guys at the local Muni, my good friend Joe Powers, an old guy I have breakfast with every week, you know, we'll sit after a round of golf and talk. And a lot of that kind of replicates, you know, the old tavern experience, because that's all you've got. You don't have a neighborhood tavern out there.
Yeah.
And Joe will sit back and enumerate all the old places he's stopped in for years, and he can name the owners, and you realize what impact that had on his life.
Yeah, I think it's essential to the fabric of a neighborhood and a city, Colin. You must do, of course.
Yeah. Well, like, you know, I was saying earlier, before we got on the air, I said a lot of my customers won't let me retire.
Yeah.
You know, it's when you have a place long enough, it becomes much more than what you've, you know, what it started out being. And you wind up, I always kid that I'm like Charon the boatman, just getting people across the River Styx. You just leave me two coins. And you wind up being a caretaker more than an owner. I don't know how you feel about it.
Yeah, how do you feel?
The alehouse is open. I think the goat's open every day of the year, aren't they?
It is. Every day. But
we're open every day of the year. And one of the reasons we're open every day of the year is because people, after, especially on Christmas or Thanksgiving, they need a place to come after spending time with their family. And it's fun to watch them come in after and decompress, because, a good drinking establishment is really a very useful, functional place for people's well-being. Yes, we have alcoholics and we...
Sure, but the point, and I've often gotten that since I've written about taverns and saloons for so long, that I get this, well, why do you write about these saloons all the time? What's the big deal about them? They just make alcoholics. Believe me, and I think you guys will tell, an alcoholic can go into Walgreens and go downstairs and drink himself to death. That they don't make alcoholics. Alcoholics will find, having grown up with one, will find places to drink. The booze at bars is not free, ladies and gentlemen.
You know what? You know, Rick, it's funny. I just want to touch on this a second. One of the things I think the importance of a bar is that, it may not, it seems kind of trivial, but I think it helps people find relevance in life. You know, a lot of people feel like they're not connected to anything.
Yeah.
You know, and it helps them feel relevant, you know, meaning. You know, or they go someplace where, where somebody actually gives them value. Because you're walking around out there, human life can devalue on a daily basis.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. And it really kind of puts a price on you. At least you feel that way.
Gentlemen, I wish I could have you on every single – we could talk taverns every day for the rest of our lives. I admire you all greatly, and I like you beyond words. Colin Cordwell, who runs the Red Lion Pub on Lincoln Avenue just north of Fullerton. Bruce Elliott, who runs the Old Town Ale House, proprietor of the Old Town Ale House, a brilliant painter, a brilliant writer. Go to Geriatric Genius, it's his blog, or go to theoldtownalehouse.com or theredlion.com. Jeff McGill, who has been a dear friend of mine for the 35-plus years, 35 of those he was behind a bar. 1 year he's not behind a bar, but he's still a dear friend. I'm going to sign off now, but I'll be on tomorrow. I don't remember who I'm interviewing, but I'm filling in for Bill and Wendy. Kevin Richter is a great producer. Ben Cortez is a masterful engineer. His daughter, who goes to Tulane, is adorable. Colin's son is really cute, but he's too young for this girl, so I'll leave that to somebody else. I think he's too young. He seems quite mature. And that's it. You get some commercials, and then I think you have the business hour.